Hey there, Shop Maniacs! You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front-end web design and development. I am Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
Hello, everybody! Oh, gosh, my voice. Losing it a little bit.
Oh, having a holly jolly, too much holly jolly in your voice.
Yeah. I had a flight on Saturday, and I'm not going to, like, make the whole beginning of this podcast about the flight, but it was one of those just, like, most harrowing travel, you know. Anything that could have gone wrong did go wrong pretty much. I mean, there was a moment where we're like holding Ruby stuck on a hot plane on the tarmac, having to pee so bad he can taste it while covered in baby vomit. And it was just like, I think I'm 100. I've like, this is a special form of hell just for us. It's incredible.
No, traveling with kids is a gray hair factory. I had a interesting thing this like weekend.
Yeah.
I don't know. We don't talk about our personal lives a whole bunch on the show, but went camping. Heck yeah. Camping. I love it. I have a pop-up
set. So jealous.
Pop-up camper, right?
Explain it.
Oh, it's great. It's a 2008. Yeah. Rockwood Freedom.
Do you hand crank it open or does it have an electric?
Well, no, I have an electric thing, electric crank, but we get out to the campsite. Crank doesn't work. And you're just sitting around like, well, and there's a manual thing.
There's
got
to be a backup manual, yeah.
There is a manual, but like I didn't have the sockets with me. You know, I like, you know, I had some sockets, but that was for like the wheels to get the like wheels off in case I have a flat, which has happened. But I was just like, dang it. In my, the friends we camp with, he had a power drill, but forgot his sockets because he's had his motor go out.
Did you walk around the campsite knocking on tents?
Well, we should have probably investigated that more. And there's like a Walmart, like 25 miles away. I could have like driven to and like tried to get sockets, but it's like 9 o'clock. Kids are ready for bed. Like, we're just like, what do we do? And we, you know, even a policeman came to help us and he like had a bunch of half a socket set, like every person in America does. And,
every socket except the one you
need. Exactly. And so like we, just were like, okay, you know what? We just gotta go home. So we went home and then I got like a power drill and a socket and it was like got it back up the next morning or like proved
did
that
sleep
I could
at
like,
home. Screw it.
Slept at home. Yeah. We just were like, this is too much effort. So we reset and it was great. Perfect weather. Like wonderful. But it was like one of those situations where you're just like, the plan did not execute. So what do we do? You know, like, and you have to kind of, I think life is kind of all about those times actually, you know, they absolutely suck, but they're like, I don't know. It's good to get yourself into situations that you don't want to be in.
I had a pop-up too and I sold it just cause when I bought it, I was like, well, I'm upgrading here from I had sold my Volkswagen Westfalia van again, you know, that was because I was so sick of like how underpowered it was. And it just wasn't as fun to drive as
it doesn't quite go up hills.
No, and I didn't, like merging on highways was always like, come on, you know, I'm like 35 is my top speed here, folks. You're going to have to work with me. It was beautiful. And then I just camp with a lot of stuff. So like when you look at pictures of a Westfalia, you know, you're like, oh, this is amazing. The bucket seats, they swivel around, the top pops up. There's a table in there. There's a stove and a little fridge. And it's all this like German engineering where there's like anywhere there's like, you know, 1 cubic inch of space. There's like a little drawer where you can keep your waterproof matches. You know, it's like this amazing piece of engineering. But then, you know, once your dog is in it and your guitar and your banjo's in it and your 3 camping chairs and your cooler and your bag, you know, your luggage and all this stuff.
Camp
it's
stove,
filled to the gills.
Yeah.
So the photographs are lame. And then so you can't pull into a campsite and then just be like, oh, we're camping now. It's like just as much unpacking and setting up as anything else. I'll tell you what, though, these like vans, these like conversion vans that people they're popular out here in Bend and they are gorgeous. And you kind of can organize those such that all your stuff is kind of in there but put away. So you really do just kind of pull up and you're ready to go.
Interesting. So it's like a 15 passenger and you just stop and chuck out your tent.
I don't think they're originally designed for passengers. They're more of the like empty shell kind of vans that are intended for like, I don't know, flower delivery or what. But I think they're probably the top seller these days is actually designing them to be converted. And then they have big, nice engines in them and they're, you know, big four wheel drive and they're just not little piece of junk cars. They're like legit. Yeah. I don't know. It's definitely in my future unless I
was a so my camper broke and so immediately you're like I'm buying a new one. So you're just like you let's see what's out there.
Oh, I got
well, no, not quite, but I same thing. It's like you look at photos, you know, and it's just two people in their 50s enjoying a cup of coffee in front of their camper, man. Yeah. And I'm like, well, where are the kids? And where's the dog that poops in the thing? And then where's the, you know, like where are like all the stuff? Where's all the stuff? Where's the like, you know, the
right?
I don't
right,
know.
Right, right. You if you you gotta just
French press that doesn't work. Where is that?
You gotta commit to true minimalism if you're gonna be, you know, like Instagram ready camping or whatever. Look at this link.
Right.
I gotta send you this link. I know this is terrible for roadie era, but I saw this on some website and it blew my mind. This is like if you're really, really rich. This is the camper this is the camper to buy.
It's check.
Like, you see this thing? Oh my God.
Oh, what?
So it's like a pull behind, you know, so you have a truck, which is kind of my preferred way to do it. So you have a nice car and then you camp and then you detach it and you still got your car. That's my thing. So the URL is Romoto, R-O-M-O-T-O-W. And it's like this pull behind camper. And then when you, but it looks incredible. But then when you park it, it like pivots 90 degrees with the shell of it still there. So you have this like elevated porch. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Look at this thing. It's, I mean, it's $350,000, so it's a little
out of the... Hey, that's what second mortgages are for. You taught me that. So. Oh, boy. Yowza.
Oh, well, we didn't plan to talk about camping, but...
Hey, welcome to Camp Talk Show. It's a podcast all about camping.
Let's talk about technology for something. Do you... what is there... I'm curious. Is there any technology that you're, like, loving lately? Like... Are you into anything specifically? Or are you?
You know what I'm chasing down?
Yeah.
Constant quest here. HTML. I want to write HTML and give it superpowers. That's what I want in life.
Yeah.
And you got a few choices. You can go React, right? But now you got a React and a build pipeline. No matter how much Kent C. Dodds says you can use vanilla React without JSX, he's lying. You can, but whatever, no one does. You know, you get into like a huge build pipeline. There's, you know, Vue, which is actually, you know, it's a 20 kilobyte gzip hit or something, you know,
so like almost like a jQuery. What you're focused on here is you like HTML with superpowers, as you put it. You want to write.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like the authoring of HTML is great. You know, I'm currently trying to untangle like a jQuery app. And I say jQuery app because it's 64 jQuery files all slung together and somehow miraculously spitting out a website, you know?
Sure. I think a lot of us have been in that position. I currently live that, you know, but it's a slow untangling and it's hopefully somewhat methodical and stuff. And I'll tell you that I personally really enjoy that. Anytime we ditch a jQuery file for a React component, because I've had so many bugs throughout life, you know, the lifespan of this app that are like, oh, there's a selector that's just not selecting what it should be selecting anymore because somebody changed the DOM and now it's broken and there was no test for that kind of thing.
And there's other, I'll call them modern inventions, like NPM, you know, like you have a dependency list right there. It's not some... you know, third party lib folder in your data, in your like JS folder that just has copy pasted files in it. You know, it's like actual dependencies. Now we like this last couple of weeks, we've had a quite serious issue with NPM where like a very popular event stream was like mining Bitcoins because somebody basically socially engineered their way as an administrator on the project. Nightmare scenario there. And like committed code to another repo that turned on and off Bitcoin through a package.json description or something like that.
Are you talking about NPM? Because it's kind of like if you go down the route of React or Vue or whatever, then you're pretty much you're into NPM immediately. And then,
yeah, I mean, the stuff I'm playing with Vue is actually very like just include the Vue bundle, you know, or the Vue.
Yeah, I think it's easier with Vue, right? Because it comes with like state management automatically, and it comes with
it's the full package. It's 20 kilobytes. It's pretty nice. It's basically a jQuery replacement at that point, you know. Okay. Which again, maybe just saying that I should watch myself, but I guess you have like the authoring again is very HTML-y is what I want to say.
Yeah. Are you doing the Vue file thing like .vue?
Not yet. But I'm just kind of like, how easy would it be to switch to that? You know, is it like,
trying to avoid, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah. So right now I'm just kind of like, you know, like, can I just write a one-off component as a Vue thing, you know, and then I just put the element placeholder in my HTML or whatever. So my dash element, you know, so that's what I'm kind of looking at. I'm, you know, I'm constant quest here.
Is Vue the closest thing for you?
I think Vue's close. You know, Angular has a very HTML-y authoring, you know, and what I like about Angular is you get a folder and inside for your component, and inside that folder are four files, a TypeScript file for the JavaScript, an HTML file for the markup, a SAS file for the SAS, and a test file for tests, like for that component.
Right.
So I really like that. Like, that's probably the direction we'll go, just because like the thing we need most is organization, you know, and Vue and React, they don't really come with organization, you know. They're just kind of like, hey man, do whatever you want. So Angular is very much like, actually, here's how you should organize a project. So I like that. So
yeah, it is pretty opinionated that way, right? All the stuff lives in those little folders. I can see how that can be highly desirable.
Yeah, but I'm just for me and my work and what I do and what I like to do, I'm just, that's what I'm thinking about is like, how do I just HTML with superpowers? And there's also this.
Do you care about state and re-rendering, or is that not, you don't even care about that really?
I care about state. Like I definitely like want to use a state object of some kind of store.
Okay. So you can't use something super lightweight like lit HTML or hyper HTML or something, because it's not enough.
No, I could. Like, I mean, I guess like, you know, you think of like the example, I need to maybe collect these examples, right, and build them or whatever, but like a login button, right? Like that's the number one thing, you know, like, oh, you click this button, some, you know, fetch call is called and it goes to the server and comes back with a token, and you store that token and then you make other calls, you know, like you need a component that does that. And then you say, show a username and an avatar, you know what I mean? Like you get the token and then you display a username and avatar. Like, that would be like the, I don't know, that'd be the most like simple example. And, you know, with state, you know, you get the user, awesome, dump that into the global state or the you know, the big state object, and then if your components could be like, oh, that changed, great, I'll just re-render myself, like that's awesome too, you know what I mean? Like, right. Even just from a, like,
it sounds, I don't know, like you're in Vue land then.
I think I am. I mean, you get a lot of like if statements in your code, but that's what you have kind of just in PHP or whatever, you know, like you just, it's like if user dot armpit equals true, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you can. That's up to you to organize nicely, though, because your component can have functions within the component, and like, I don't know. I know what you mean. That like looking at a lot of logic at the HTML level looks pretty gnarly, but you can kind of be like, okay, well, this is a true break in logic. I am going to write an if statement in there, or I don't know, whatever the kind of logical and stuff that templating tends to use, but it's just going to call one function or call the other function. So at least I'm not going to like look at 40 lines of code and then see an else statement with another 25 lines of code after that. You can still organize it somewhat nicely that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now even like at the parent, you can be like, you know, just pass in the user and then this component's going to know, you know, all the children in here will know whether, you know, to respond to the user, you know, that's a cool thing. Anyway, I that's what I'm trying to do. So, you know, it's stuff like, you know, user accounts, you know, shopping carts, stuff like that. You know, mm-hmm. we made a big deal in the early 2000s where like you click add to order and the whole product would like fly off of the page using prototype and go into your little cart icon. You know, you remember those demos? And you like click, it would go all the way up to the top of the page and dunk into the cart.
That's when people cared about. It's like, it feels like back when we had time.
But you know, I think it's maybe kind of wangy now, but like, you know, like you could start doing that stuff again, or it's a little easier, you know, like, you know, if you like when you edit the, when you add quick add to order, you're actually editing or adding to the session cart.
Vue might help you. I don't know if you're actually going to build something like that, but Sarah Drasner once showed me how all the like transition group and transition elements work mm-hmm. in Vue, and it does automatic flip for you, you know, that first last input like whatever, so it kind of like calculates where it should go, then puts it there, then like transforms it back where it was, so that when it does animate it, it's like incredibly buttery, you know. And mm-hmm. so like if you wanted to have a little shoes component go flying into the cart in Vue land, you're going to get that smooth flip style animation for free.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And like React, which is, again, you need like a pretty serious, right? Well, yeah, like a React transition or something like that.
I don't know. It's been a while since I've done animation in React. Is there some kind of, I think if there's built-in stuff, it's mostly class manipulation helpers. But there's probably a million libs.
I think there is, but you know, it gets into that like wrapper element, like the context sort of stuff, you know.
Yeah, I do. I will tell you that in JSX, that nesting of stuff can get so deep, especially when you add like we're using GraphQL on top of it, and so now your components are wrapped within the query components too. It's literally mm-hmm. like an angle bracket component that has render props and a callback thing, so it's like adds yet a little bit more nesting at the highest level to your stuff, and you can nest queries too.
Are you saying you'd want a little separation between behavior and markup? Is that kind of what you're getting at? Some sort of separation of concerns?
It does. I have been thinking a lot about that idea, though. Of, you know, you mentioned it too. Like, I need to go fetch the user object, and then now I have some data about the user object, and I'm going to render things depending on what I got back. That all of a sudden kind of became a new front-end developer concern. It didn't just happen this week. I'm sure there's been devs dealing with this for years, but it's somewhat new to me to be thinking about this stuff very regularly. But that's probably not the only component on the page that has that duty. There's probably other things too. So which one happens first, and how can I order that priority? And what happens in that middle state before that is done? Should I render a placeholder component? How sure am I about what's going to come back? Like, am I setting CSS hard-coded widths and heights to make sure that content isn't going to reflow weirdly when the content arrives, or can I animate it in some way? And should I show a spinner or not show a spinner? Or should I wait to delay the spinner? And should I be lazy loading? And is styles already be loaded on the page, or should the styles be dynamically loaded too? It's this really massive can of worms of what is the loading experience of a, you know, JavaScript rendered app like? Is that just assumed that the front-end developers of today know how to make all those choices correctly? Because I'll tell you what, I've been a front-end developer for a long time, and I don't know how to deal with this stuff perfectly.
Well, and like, yeah, like there's design and development, you know, choices there, you know what I mean? And so it's like, I want HTML with superpowers, that's what I want. But I also know, you know, like, I think of like David K. Piano's, that's not his real last name. The X state stuff. We had a whole episode kind of about like like state systems, you know, because I know, you know, I'm going to have a loading. I'm going to have a, you know,
I love that stuff.
Content in. I'm going to have like a content overflow.
But kind of the sound bite there is like, can you make impossible states impossible to render? Because that's what bites mm-hmm. you a lot of times with bugs in an app, is that your app got into some state that's like was unknowable and bizarre and wrong. In a mm-hmm. really proper state machine, and just say there are no impossible states. You've dealt with all states, and your app is in one of these states, and these are the correct states that it can possibly be in.
Well, yeah, and you think too, like, you know, testing wise, like, wouldn't that be a lot easier to figure out? You know, like, oh, I just, you know, when this doesn't have a user, it's in a loading state or a empty state, and then when it's like getting a user, make sure it's in the, I don't know how you'd like intercept a loading state, you know, but in like a user test, but like, yeah, it just kind of like, or in like an end to end kind of test or whatever, but like, yeah, it just, there's so many, you know, like, I guess it just, it writes out, like it self documents, like kind of what it needs to do and what it expects, you know?
That anyway. Was the moment where I laughed about, like, let's say you're, you know, building a React or Vue component, whatever, like something that has a very component like structure. It could be anything really. The idea is, if you're going with state machines, is to describe all the possible states of this component at the top of the component. And then I was like, well, I'm in GraphQL land, so we're describing what kind of data this component needs at the top of this component. And CSS and JS libraries are massively popular, and assuming you go that route, then all the styling for this component's at the top of the component too. And in Vue land, you know, and in, you know, you're writing the not only the template, the HTML part of it, but the you know, the functionality of it too, all the functions and stuff that it's going to call. It's like, holy cow, these components are big, huge.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm even in this jQuery app thing, it's like these things are huge, like just nested too. And but what I like, you know, getting into the modern script or whatever, that, back to that NPM thing, it's like you know, you can get a dependency tree if you're using, you know, import statements instead of like include in the right order statements, you know. Like, so there just seems like there's so many benefits to, or just small, like ergonomics or whatever. So yeah, it's like, you know, Webpack is actually smart enough to be like, you never imported that, so I'll never import that. So, you know, that's kind of cool. So yeah, it's like they only use the code you use, just even on the main bundle, but you can even do that on the page level, you know, route level too. But that's kind of, I don't know. Everyone makes that sound so easy, but I'm just like, well, I'll get to that. So that's going to be an optimization later, I hope. So.
This episode of Shop Talk Show was brought to you in part by Sentry. That's Sentry.io. It's an error tracking app that, in my opinion, is not optional for your web app. You need something that is tracking errors, how often they happen, and telling you when they happen, especially if they're happening frequently, and getting, you know, notified, and even possibly routing those errors to the right developer, all stuff that Sentry can do. Relying on your customers to do that for you is just foolhardy, you know? Like, you don't want to be like, just be pushing out bugs and then just being like, hey, who sees a problem? You know, have the whole world QA your app for you. It's just rude, kind of, and not good for business. You know, anytime a customer sees an error is bad news. They're trying to use your app to do something, probably paying you money to do that thing, and it's really a bummer when there's errors. We can't anticipate everything in the whole world that they're going to do on your app. I mean, ideally, you have all kinds of tests
And believe me, we try to do that. You know, I mean, every app I've ever worked on, it just feels wonderful to have tests. Every test you write is like almost a warming feeling of, oh, yes, another, you know, guard against a problem that may happen. But there's no way you're going to get infinite coverage. I mean, it's just there's too many permutations of something a user might be able to do. So be smart, code smart, have lots of tests, but also have error tracking like Sentry in place so that when things go wrong, you're notified of them. You know, and you can fix stuff. I mean, half our lives of software development is just fixing problems. It's just the way it is. It's just the way it is. So thanks so much, Sentry, for your support. Everybody else out there who's hasn't checked it out, go do it.
I guess we could do some questions, huh?
Yeah, we got some questions. You know, we're kind of rounding out the year. We really appreciate everyone who's asked a question. It's always the best part in the meat and taters of the Shop Talk Show. Thank you very much. Dario Fusinato writes in, I'm starting to build an app and I'm on a crossroad. Should I manage backend myself or use backend as a service? On one hand, with backend as a service, I can focus more on front end and do backend tasks more easily. But the price is going up for sure. Also, for this, as this project is scaling, I might hit a point of no return, and I'm stuck with backend as a service, and probably costs more, not being able to do custom things.
Yeah, maybe. I'd like to define this though, because to me it's very nebulous these days of what even backend as a service even means. Like, what do you think what's an example of it?
In my mind, and this is just an experience I've had, is kind of like those CMSs that kind of do CRUD management, like create, read, update, delete.
Yeah.
Know, you kind of be like, okay, I have a posts have titles, body, and an author, and the author actually points to this other thing. Let me go define author. Author has a name, an email, Twitter,
so it's not handle, it's that, but like, it's not even self-install. Like, it's on their servers. It's
just in the cloud. Yeah. And then you're like, hey, give me some JSON for my app,
right? Which, okay, that's what I thought of too. It's not like just use Heroku or something. That's like backend as a service, but it's like, it's nothing. They don't give you anything. You're still running all that stuff. You're still doing it yourself.
Yeah, I would call that like infrastructure as a service, right? Yeah. Like the servers.
Right.
But maybe that's what they mean. But
what's other examples? I know like Contentful would be like what you're talking about, right? Like a CMS, right, in the cloud thing where you hit the, and then sanity.io it has sponsored. They're kind of similar. I think they're self-install, but at least they give you this, like, you know, it's definitely CRUD, but it's a fancy CRUD with, you know, some kind of interesting query language around it and stuff. What are other examples of this?
There's a project a long time ago called Buckets. It was kind of like a version of this, which I played around with quite a bit because I was like, you know, this could maybe get me from point A to B faster, you know?
Like, let's say you're like, what about like throwing up WordPress on Heroku or whatever or somewhere.
Yeah, if I can one-click install WordPress.
Is that the same, is that backend as a service then, or because you're managing it yourself in some way that it's kind of not anymore?
I bet if you did it all through the admin, it would qualify as backend as a service, right?
Yeah.
Like, but if you're like, oh, I gotta like install the, or like maybe plugins is actually makes it stronger. But if you had to like, you're like, oh wait, I got to go into the theme and
Firebase,
edit something. I think, yeah. Firebase, is that one?
Is it?
Yeah.
It doesn't give you any like,
I mean,
it's not like you kind of get CRUD, but it's kind of like manage your own data structure in a way, but you get login and you get a bunch of stuff. Does it, I don't know if it's firmly in backend as a service. That's what I mean. It's like, yeah, these terms are so a little nebulous. Maybe they're not for everybody. They seem like it to me, though.
Yeah, let's see. Maybe let's consult the internet gods for a backend as a service definition. Cloud computing, check. Serves as a middleware, provides developers a way to connect their mobile web and application to cloud services using APIs and SDKs. This, I hate this already. What, no, like, what a bunch of nonsense words. Compared to other service models, BaaS, which is cool, cool name, is rather new and limited number of providers. So, huh.
Whatever. I think we
push notifications,
well.
Server code. Yeah.
What do you mean? What should Dario do? Should he start with this, or is it inherently limiting? You know, and that he's going to regret it at some point. And it's going to be hard to migrate off, or something like that.
I mean, I think you can anticipate the limitations if it's like one of these kind of content storage services. I was considering one for day trip, and I immediately was like to replace a whole Rails app. Basically, I was like, well, we could just use this maybe. I was considering that, but then the more I thought about it, it was like, well, you know, I'm doing geo queries, like geolocation based queries. And that was, you know, sort of a deal breaker for me, right? Like it was just like, oh, okay. Like I'm not going to be able to roll that into this like content CMS. So I'm just going to have to roll my own backend. That said, I'm using Heroku to deploy that just because I don't want to manage AWS on this side project. You know, I want to pay $7 a month to like keep the site running, you know? So maybe that helps. Like those were my lines. Like I just want like a very, I want whatever gets it to the all the service stuff to be handled, like infrastructure to be handled. But for the content stuff in this situation, I just was like, you know, I know I'm going to need geolocation and a login, and I'm going to do it with this service. That said, you know, maybe you just list out a few features and make sure that those core critical features are matched up into this this backend as a service. I don't know.
It's funny that I can't. Are there dozens of these, or are they a little bit, are they not as big as we think? I found one called parseplatform.org seems like a little bit in this category. Maybe progress.com is a little in there. Envy. I don't know. It just seems like, why don't I don't hear about these things at all. Maybe this is a little opening in the market here for people.
Yeah. Oh, I'm seeing a new buzzword called backendless. Yes.
Why not? But if you're going this route, it's almost like assuming that you already have infrastructure as a service, that this is on top of that, probably. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I bet that acts as some kind of, and then your front end sits somewhere else. Like, so I mean, here's what I'm going to say. Go for it. And please blog your experience so yes, others can benefit. I mean, if it's, you know, pretty simple, the things I would be worried about are like if you're, you know, need to take payment, you know what I mean? Like, and you're not using Stripe or something like that, you know, how do you do it? You know, like, are you going to be able to do it?
That's what I would see in the world of serverless. That's what's more, I don't know. It's not like I speak for the world of this type of stuff, but what I've seen a lot of, I think, is this, like, I'm going to piece together all the little bits that I need. Oh, I need to store some data. I'm going to chuck it in Firebase or FaunaDB. I need to take payments. Well, I'm going to make a serverless function that talks to Stripe. So I have that going on. Oh, I need data. Well, or I need like a blog, you know, I need like structured content. Well, I'll use Contentful or I'll hit my WordPress API. Well, I need to store images nicely though. Well, I'll store them in Cloudinary. They have APIs for that. You know, like you piece together all the bits that you need to build what you're trying to build, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Which I kind of like. I think a lot of people are like, that makes them vomit a little bit. Like, oh my God, you really tied this thing together with duct tape. But I don't know that that's true. I think that's, you've decided to outsource, you know, these companies that provide these specific little things are doing it API driven. So theoretically for you, it's not impossible to move to a different API. And they're really incentivized to do a great job with the little part that they do. I kind of like that. Mm-hmm. Once you have a startup of any significant size, you look at all the software that your startup runs on and it's already huge. You know, there's, you already... You're already 50 dependencies deep, you know. What's 60?
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, Stripe is probably the best, you know, like I've written payment gateways before. Never want to do that again, basically. You know what I mean? Like, it's awful, you know? And so I would probably reach for Stripe until it doesn't work for me, you know? But then, you know, then I have to do a big back out, you know? So it is, I don't know. I guess I'm kind of confirming Dario's fears that it could be bad, could be a tough back out, you know, if you kind of go in one direction. But yeah, anyway, I don't know. Yes, that's going to be my final answer.
Stanton writes in. I've been listening with pleasure to your podcast for a while now. I've never heard you debate the merits of various agile methodologies, e.g. Scrum, Kanban, etc. As a developer at a small digital agency who's wrestling with these questions, I'd love to hear your opinions on the matter.
Well, Stanton, do I have a post for you?
Do you?
Oh yeah. Hold on.
Money-driven management?
Yeah, money-driven management. What you do is you give people tokens. They're called monies. And for every good job they do, they get a token. And that incentivizes them to earn more tokens, right? This concept is actually very popular. It dates back to ancient China. It is just in what they discovered is you could pay people to do work, and they'll do that work. And then you come back. If they didn't do the work, then they don't get any more monies. And so it's the state of Agile 2018. Martin Fowler.
He writes a lot about this back end service stuff.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, the state of, so well, Martin Fowler was kind of one of the original signatures on the Agile Manifesto.
Oh, I see.
But he gave this talk at Agile Australia this year, and it's about the state of Agile. And he kind of, I don't know, summed up all my opinions. You know, he gives this whole idea of dark Agile or dark Scrum or faux Agile or something, and he even calls it the Agile Industrial Complex, which is awesome. But it's about how like kind of like enterprise companies can kind of get sucked into this whole like Agile or not Agile, hot or not, you know, like do you even Agile, bro, sort of stuff. And they are, and he's just kind of like, that's like so far from the original intent, you know, that like it's inevitable that Agile would be, there would be an enterprise version of something that worked at a very small scale or like a 10, 20 person shop.
I kind of get that we're far away from, you know, because it seems like at our company, we don't follow any particular, I don't reference any documentation to learn if we're doing Agile correctly. So I'm sure that we're not, there's no guiding philosophy to how we work yet. We do push code like every day-ish, so it feels agile. So it's easier to be like, oh, yeah, we're agile. We have stand-ups. We have stand-ups and we push code a lot, so we're agile.
Yeah, no, I mean, and that's how I think like that would like fit into the original definition. You know what I mean? Like, and like, do the people implementing this stuff, do they kind of like, are they A, responsible for it, and do they kind of like have a say in what gets done, you know? Or is it kind of this totally top down thing where, you know, up on high it's kind of decided, and then we kind of like then make the minions do all the work, you know? I am not a fan of that just because I feel like it dehumanizes people. But yeah, I like Scrum. I think Scrums are fine. I've just my whole thing with Agile or any of this is I've never seen it like functioning great. That's like any like serious process. I've never really seen it functioning great. And then everyone's like, oh, well, that's not true Agile. And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, there's no true Scotsman would do Agile wrong. That, you know, of course, you know, no one would do agile wrong, but let's just say there's a company that does, you know. But so it's like, if it's so easy to mess up, it's really not a great system or whatever. But I think that's also just how humans translate hearsay, you know. That said, you know, I think there's very good and efficient like project and product managers who can do it and make, you know, I honestly think it all comes down to that person in that role, how they manage a project.
Yeah, isn't that just like what we need is good managers, and what we need is people considering what their workflow is like at their company and identifying when it fails and identifying when it's successful and trying to make it more successful as they go. You don't need to read a book, right, to tell you like, if you're not doing these methodologies, then you're a dummy at your company. Because there's things that don't work. Yeah. We make fun of Waterfall because it's totally sucks for making websites. It's not appropriate for decisions to be made in a closed door room with just decision makers, and then have it just passed to design for them to pretty it up, and then have those pretty designs passed down to development for them to just work on, and then it's QA'd and shipped out the door. I'm talking the way I am because it's so clearly ridiculous. There's all kinds of back and forth that needs to happen for this thing to have any level of success at all. So we've learned that. I'm sure there's some enemies that have some version of Waterfall still, but like for the most part, it's almost like everybody works this way. They're like, oh, we involve developers in the process early on, you know, like they're reinventing somewhere. It's like, nah, we all do that now because you have to.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, yeah. As far as like other specific methodologies, like, you know, scrums, you know, I don't know. I know there's a difference between like scrums and standups, but I'm just going to say they're the same thing, but like,
I do like the one thing where you have to say what you did, what you're going to do. And if you have any blockers, it's kind of a nice little mini format.
No, I like that. I tell a bot what I did every day, you know, or multiple bots, you know, and I think that's a good thing. But you know, it doesn't always, you know, I don't know. It doesn't always work. So, it depends on if people are reading it or whatever. I think that stuff is good. I think that's just like enforcing a daily check-in and giving a framework for how you talk about things. I don't think it needs to always be so rigid or whatever. I think just like enforcing a check-in and making sure everyone talks. Cause if you have a team member who kind of goes silent on your team, that chances are there's a problem, you know, like they're overwhelmed or can't, you know, that it can present a problem. Kanbans are great just for visual, like ticketing. I do find that people get way more focused on the product manager side on how many issues they're clearing out. They want the burn charts to go down or whatever they do. I think people just think of like, oh, we just got to clear issues. But like, you know, as a developer, I'm like, no, we kind of got to get to the core of problems. I can fix the checkout bug you like listed, but like the core problem with all the JavaScript's bad, that's like a bigger problem, which you only care about closing the issue right now, but I kind of care about solving the problem for good, you know? So it's stuff like that, right? Like I think all that like technical debt stuff falls through the crack. So I don't know. People have backlogs, but they never get to them. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Good. Anyway. Good luck, Stanton.
I'd love to hear your thoughts. I'd love to read. I'd love to read more, but my feelings of the Agile Industrial Complex were echoed by.
Yeah, I should watch that.
Martin Fowler.
That would be good. You know, I didn't realize there was like an epidemic of bad workflows or something. You know, where I'm at the moment, it's just like, I don't know. If you have a bad workflow, that's your fault. Fix it.
Yeah.
Jim Nielsen's thinking about changing the URLs on his blog from a human readable format, one that includes like, I don't know, /blog/title of post here kind of thing, to an ID based format, like /blog/01141.8. And he says, why would you commit such a travesty, you ask? Well, now that I've been publishing on the web for years, I'm finding IDs to be more friendly in terms of longevity. For example, right now, if I update a resource like a blog post and its content changes, then the URL no longer perfectly reflects the changes I made. Thus, I have to change the URL, which means I have to set up a redirect. Or if my URLs are based on IDs and content agnostic, I never have to worry about breaking links. Human-friendly URLs seem like a commonly held best practice, but balancing brevity and longevity, I'm leaning towards short ID-based URLs. You've been publishing on the web for a long time. What do you have? Thoughts, opinions, knee-jerk reactions to this? You know, I've seen it both ways, isn't it? Stack Overflow kind of does both, don't they?
The ID dash slug.
Yeah, there's a big old slug, and then there's a bunch of words in it. And I think there's some proof-ish that the words in the URL have some SEO value to them. I would assume that CSSTricks.com/flexbox probably doesn't hurt that it has flexbox in the URL. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think there's like a very very subtle like. Am I on the right page kind of thing, you know, for users? Like just kind of like, okay, that URL says, you know, the topic I'm actually looking for. Okay, let's read it, you know. I think there's still an SEO benefit, but I actually don't know if that's true. The ID stuff, you know, I think it's okay. I know, like, there's at least Rails or something or... Someone was pitching like a ID dash, you know, short or text, you know, or slugged. And I think the system, the router of whatever kind was like smart enough to only parse the digits, you know? So it was just like, oh, I'll just like split the digits and then I'll go request, you know, by ID, which is super faster than request by slug, just because it's a number and not a, you know, it's like an incremental number, not like a text string to compare. And yeah, so I think like that's the, I think that's a cool way to do it just from a data performance, you know. That said, Chris Enns has started changing the slugs on these shows to be ID based. So just by episode number. So it should be kind of easier. So it might be some convenience there. But in general, I like the slug.
I like the slug too. But, I think it's just.
But ID dash slug, that's cool too.
You know, and you could do it because there's so you could make it ID slash slug, but the slug doesn't matter. It could be just a place. It could just be anything, you know, and it will still render the right page, which you'd think, oh, that's definitely bad for SEO because you shouldn't have multiple URLs that, you know, like a wildcard URL that renders the same thing. That's bad, but that's mitigated by, did I use the right word? By a canonical tag, you know, just put the canonical tag there that says this page, wherever it renders the SEO, the correct version of it is this. And then your SEO is kind of maintained there.
Yeah.
Wildcard URLs. I think you should. Maybe. That way you could use the slug or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Or change the slug.
It is such a big deal, though. There should be more conference talks on URL design. It seems easy in the early days, you know? And then as an app grows, it becomes a significant portion of technical debt, you know, especially if you've chosen whatever you choose at the highest level, you know, like if, I don't know, if CodePen just allowed you to be like, hey, when you make a pen, you just pick a slug and then it's codepen.io/whatever that slug is will render your pen. That would have been a disaster because we have no namespace control right at the beginning of the URL. Like that's not good, you know, you want to bury those. Anything that's really wildcardy needs to be at least namespace one level, you know? Yes. Like, it's nice to have twitter.com/Chris Coyer, but it's almost surprising to me that they even offer that. It's, like, kind of nice to have /you/Chris Coyer or something. Because then every time, I mean, it happens all the time that you're like, oh, my gosh, somebody has /account. Oh, that's nice. Thanks, you know? Now we have to, like, go in there and ask them to... or just change their URL on them or something and then blacklist that word so nobody else can get it again. And it's just, be careful at the high level.
It's kind of like a Reddit has it right. They figured it out. So Twitter has this problem too. They have to like people like registered with admin, you know,
yeah, stuff like it's that. It's not that big of a problem because you can just be like, well, no, sorry, we reserve the right to change it on you. So I'm not going to delete your account, but I'm going to change it to admin dash one or something so that it. But that's, you don't want to get yourself in that situation because now you're solving a one-off problem instead of solving it kind of systemically, you know?
Yeah, that's what I always think about. You know, I wonder too, this is maybe the last thought here, but like with GraphQL coming on the scene,
it's the best.
Cool guy Graph, which, yeah, very bullish on that. But like, you know, so much of my REST URL structure, which is, you know, the very predictable structure you have, like whatever the model is slash show slash edit, you know, slash delete or whatever. My RESTful URL structure from the backend kind of goes out the window because it doesn't even, it's not even pegged to like, I'm not even using REST anymore. You know, I'm just querying whatever I need for that view at that minute, you know? So like, are we headed back to like ? Or what, you know, what's the future for URLs? I don't know. It's, I feel like URL structure is so tied to the backend, right? Or the, I guess it'd be the router in this case, but like, you know, but a lot of frameworks and whatever enforce like good back, like route conventions, you know, like RESTful route conventions, which made sense. So it made good URLs, but what are we getting into? So, but maybe those that was too cumbersome and that's why we're moving away from it. Like, I know I had that problem occasionally. Like, you just like the slash, I don't know. You're like, I want it to be slash me and that's my profile. And it's so much work to do that, you know? So, I don't know.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Gumroad. Like gum, like chewing gum. Gumroad.com/shoptalkshow. I bet you've seen it before because it's all over the place. It's this great e-commerce platform to help you sell particularly digital stuff. So, you know, podcasters use it or musicians will use it to like sell their album because you need to like be delivered the digital files of the albums, or writers will use it to sell a book, or little app, you know, creators will use it to sell their little app. Here's an example of where you might come across it. I came across this little app called Pixel Snap, you know, a little while back, but it's this genius little like Mac OS menu bar app with a key command, and you fire off the key command and you get little crosshairs as your cursor, and it's drawing little bars all over that to tell you the dimensions, like how many pixels away certain things are. A little hard to describe on the radio, but it's for when you're designing something and you're like, how far should that margin or padding be, or what should the width be of this particular element? You just do this thing and it just draws the little bars, and you're like, oh, I see, it's 141 pixels or whatever. It's so cool. So you go to getpixelsnap.com, you click on buy now for $15, and when you click that button, you go to Gumroad. And Gumroad, it does all the hard e-commerce part stuff. It'll be, you know, I want this, and you click the I want this button, and it takes the money from the people and gets their email address and payment information, and then gives them a nice little receipt and gives them a way to safely digitally download that file. So you don't have to build any of that infrastructure. It's not that you can't build that infrastructure, but that's a lot of work, you know, whereas Gumroad enables you to do it in 5 minutes, get set up on it. You know, it's incredible. I love using Gumroad. I like it when other people sell stuff on Gumroad because I know it's going to be easy to check out and buy. It's going to be great. So we're not selling anything at Shop Talk just yet, but we set up gumroad.com/shoptalk. So you can hit that URL to sign up for it just so you have a Gumroad account, or as particularly if you want to sell something, go do it that way.
This is a good one to end with, because we'll get back to Dave's favorite topic, web components. Michael Chilford writes in with this kind of interesting, really simple, basically CSS question about web components, is that if you attach a shadow DOM to it, like that's the old, like in this little demo, which we'll put the link to the code pen in the show notes here, it doesn't do anything. It's just div class equals my element. It could be a my element, you know, But there's, you know, you can attach a web element to a div if you want. And there's just a couple of lines of JavaScript. And what it does is it queries from my element, and then it attaches a shadow DOM to it. And then the shadow DOM has its own inner HTML. You know, that's where you, that's your, like, templating opportunity with a web component to inject your inline styles and, like, a paragraph tag in this case. And so globally on this web component, he's set here font family sans serif, you know, so it should be a sans serif font everywhere, which is not the default on the web. You know, the default on the web is serif, right? And so there's on this HTML document, there's div class equals my element, which will inject the shadow DOM, and then there's just a regular paragraph tag too. And the regular paragraph tag, it is sans serif. The CSS that's global on this page has made it sans serif, but in the shadow DOM, it's not. It's serifed because the global CSS is not, like, leaking into the shadow DOM here and applying its style to it, which is in some degree desirable. That's kind of like what you want out of the shadow DOM, is like kind of protection from the CSS of the outer world. But does that have to be that way? Doesn't that kind of suck? Does that mean every one of your web components you need to, like, inject CSS in to inherit the global styles of your website?
I think that's how it worked. Basically, it was you would, again, back to dependency trees or whatever, you're like, okay, this, you know, paragraph needs the base type styles.css, you know, and I'm going to go back to, like, a link tag. When it was a link tag, you know, your browser would be like, I don't even need to ask. I got link, or I got type.css. So I'm just going to spit that out.
So it's cached, basically. So it's not a big deal.
So it's basically cached at the lower level. Yeah. I know Angular, the project I worked on most recently, it was a lot of dancing, right? Between, oh, this style goes in the component. Actually, no, this has to go back up to the global styles, and like, it's able to work both ways. So I don't know if there's, I don't know if there's like a version of the shadow DOM or whatever that allows for bleeding, you know? I'm going to have to say, I don't know, but in general, it's the thing people want, right? Like, everyone's like, oh, you know, this whole inheritance thing is silly. Like, I should be able to specify it at the component, you know? It's like, well, that's what shadow DOM does.
I kind of like this. I think it's nice that it is a little bit, it's more protective. Nothing comes in or out, as this little demo proves.
Yep.
Nothing. Nothing. Yeah, it's like an iframe.
It's a whole new web page. Yeah, inside.
Yeah. So yes, it's on you too. Yeah. Your font family is not going to come inside here. So now it's almost like you have to almost restructure your CSS, because you're going to need some, like, probably single CSS file that is like, okay, these are the styles that I'm going to on purpose give to all web components, because they, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm deciding to do that on purpose. This sets up very basic typography rules and layout and whatnot. Helper classes. I don't know. I don't even know. But at least then you're kind of free inside there. I can write pretty loosey-goosey styles inside of a web component that I don't have to worry about infecting the world with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the way I heard Jake Archibald explain it most recently, which challenges my view of web components. My view is very much like, I want to use them like React components, build the whole app in that. Like, I want hundreds of them just peppered out, and I just assemble them together like Legos, right?
Yeah. I've kind of heard this too. That's not the intention anymore. It's more like little isolated, like,
well, his app understanding was it's more like isolated things, like a map component, yeah, or something, or a bar chart component, you know, which kind of has all the...
You might have 3 or 4 on your website, not 500 that represent your entire website.
Yeah, yeah. It's not the web components aren't the Legos. They're just the, I don't know, the... I'm using Lego analogy. It's the horse Lego, you know, it's the special one.
Maybe it's like, it's not your carpet and your railings and your stairs. It's your bathroom.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's an isolated thing. So it's not like a component. It's like a fully functioning component, or I don't know. Looking at your living room, it's your TV. It's the thing that like.
Then it seems even more laborious to style them than in a way.
Yeah, and so,
you're like, oh, I got to do all this styling choices just to deal with this silly boundary. It's not silly. It's great. It's the correct way to do a boundary.
Right.
I don't want to re-architect my CSS just for that.
Well, and it's the issue, right? It's like people hate CSS because it's permeable, or the rules of like what trumps whatever, you know, the style powers or whatever they're called. Like people hate that. But, you know, then when you get like full isolation, people are like, oh, it's not good enough. You know, where's all my styles? So it's like, we're the worst client in the world, probably, to these browser people.
Kinda, yeah. I can't think of an alternative, really, because you definitely wouldn't want to say like, oh, well, you know, font family, that does permeate boundaries, but, you know, margin doesn't. You know, that would be a disaster.
Yeah. Well, you remember when that
it's either got to be all
that red or blue CSS quiz came up and it caused a whole bunch of drama for about a week a long time ago.
Yeah.
That it made me wonder if we need, instead of the cascade in its current form instead of the cascade in its current form where like you have ID selectors are more powerful than class selectors, et cetera, maybe there needs to be an extends mode of CSS where last declaration wins. Does that make sense? Like, so I said P red.
Isn't that how it works already?
But if you had an ID as the initial and a class as the one after it, the class would never take, right? Or the...
Oh, you think so? Is this anti-specificity in a sense?
Yeah, anti-specificity mode. Like, just I wonder. Like, I don't know what that, you know, a doc type of some kind or something. It made me
like if it matches at all and it's further down the style sheet, it wins.
Last one wins. So think about it. I wonder if it works.
Maybe. It's just a different rule set, so maybe.
Yeah, you know? Just a mode in CSS, almost like use strict in JavaScript or something. I don't even know what the other modes are, but...
Yeah, because I think what it would turn into is that you still have this like list of imports, but your list of imports now is not just arbitrary. It's how strong each one is.
Yeah, kind of, or like how, you know, I don't know, how far down it goes. Like, I don't know, yeah. Like,
yeah.
Like last one wins.
Could be interesting.
Like, that'd be an interesting... I don't know.
But then you write, you know, P, and then shit, it's super powerful all of a sudden.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
Here's another possibility, though. Is there a version of Shadow DOM that allows in but not out? So anything that's global still comes inside, but you can still be loosey-goosey with your styles inside, so you can still, but none of those things that you write inside can leak out.
Yeah, no, I think that would be cool. Yeah, like a semi-permeable or one-way permeable. I mean, that would make sense with like one-way data flows, right? Like I want the things from the global to inform the you know, specific or the lower down.
Because it gives you this power as a developer then to be like, I need to style this thing, but I don't want to like wrap my mind around this entire code base's CSS specificity issues. You know, I just want to write the style and know that I'm not going to whatever tip over a bar stool in another bar or whatever, like the joke goes.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. No, I'm curious if that would work. So
maybe it exists. That's what I thought we were looking at here with it. Cause the Shadow DOM has this mode closed or mode open. I thought it was maybe you could opt into that, but that doesn't appear to do anything. I mean, it probably does something, but it's not that.
What are the modes? What's the valid? And then is that feature even written out yet? So that's the other, you know. Hey. Well, all right. Good stuff to think about, but I think we should wrap it up here. Dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star heart favorite up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
It's interesting. Yes, I would. This mode has to do with JavaScript being able to get in.
So JavaScript, but not styles? Well, I do declare that is an abomination.
Okay, I have to go drink honey water with lemon. ChopTalkShow.com.